Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host, Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
So you're with us, I think, today for the first half hour, and then you've got to go. But so let's get right into our show today. We have two more outstanding segments. Our first guest is Brendan Steinhauser. Brendan, are you with us?
I am. How are you guys doing today?
Very well. Brendan is the director of federal and state campaigns for FreedomWorks. He was the lead organizer of the 9/12 march on Washington last weekend. Brendan is a former student activist at the University of Texas and the author of The Conservative Revolution, How to Win the Battle for College Campuses. Hi, Brendan. I too, am a University of Texas grad. I was there from 1966 to 1970, and we want to welcome you to Take Aim.
Well, thank you. And
tell us how you made it from Texas to come up to Washington to work for FreedomWorks, and tell us about FreedomWorks.
Sure. Well, I did go to school at UT. I was there for 4 years, and it didn't take long. I think freshman orientation was my first introduction to the campus left. Both students and professors, and it just became very clear that as a somewhat conservative, I wasn't really active yet as a freshman, but as a conservative libertarian student, my views were not welcome. So one thing kind of led to another, and I joined a group there called the Young Conservatives of Texas, and we began to organize a little bit to fight back on campus. And one of the things that I learned at UT was how the left operates. You know, it just fascinated me how they were able to always have a lot of energy. They were always out protesting, boycotting. They were in the campus newspaper all the time. They controlled the freshman orientation. They just did such a good job of recruiting people, keeping them energized, and actually sort of owning the debate at UT. So the Young Conservatives began to fight back by learning and applying their tools, their tactics. And really, that's kind of how I cut my teeth as someone who does some organizing and things like that. I basically left UT, and a year later I was at FreedomWorks doing the same types of things for FreedomWorks.
And tell us about FreedomWorks. What is the organization? What do they do? What are they up to?
Well, FreedomWorks goes back to 1984 when it was Citizens for a Sound Economy. It basically comes out of George Mason University. It's a free market economics do tank. We do have some PhD economists around for the policy side of things, but we are an advocacy group. So we're sort of becoming the MoveOn.org of the right, a group that believes in liberty as opposed to socialism. But we have over 400,000 online members now, and that's really been just a big boost to what we've been able to do. But as a grassroots organizer, I can tell you there are so many people out there that are looking for ways to get involved to fight against big government. It's almost been, my job has been a lot easier this year because of the threats at the state level and also the federal level.
Brendan, Roger mentioned earlier in the intro about how you were the lead organizer of the 9/12 march that occurred this past weekend. What was the idea behind that march, and how did you go about organizing it?
Well, you know, it really kind of goes back to the last year when President Bush had his TARP program, and I just saw the outrage and the people that felt that was so unfair, it was violating free markets, it was something that people were appalled at. So we got through the election, you know, you sort of saw a little bit quieter time in November and December, but when President Obama came in, he started pushing the stimulus package, the anger really built up again, even louder than the previous year with the bailout. So what I saw was the grassroots came alive, and they were sort of just trying to figure out how to fight back. So they shut down phone lines during the stimulus debate. I remember that very vividly. And they were calling and they were emailing and faxing. And finally people were getting frustrated and saying, I've called Senator Spector over and over again. I can't get through now, you know. So what we were starting to tell people back at February 9th or 10th was, it's time to take to the streets. And I think that's the significant moment that kind of started to get people thinking about protesting for the first time. But it really didn't crystallize until Rick Santelli went on his rant. When Rick Santelli came out and said it's time for a Chicago Tea Party, it galvanized this thing into a movement. Within a week, there were 50 so-called Tea Parties around the country. And from that moment, I saw that the energy was real. I saw this thing was going to grow. It led toward the April 15th Tax Day Tea Parties. As that was happening and this thing was just going viral, there were just hundreds of thousands of people, you know, getting active, getting ready for April 15th. That's when I saw, okay, when this thing happens on April 15th, there are going to be a lot of people coming out. They're going to want to eventually march on Washington. So I started to put the plans in place as early as March 15th for that.
Now, what were the main goals of this march, and how close did you come to achieving those goals?
Well, you know, again, looking at the left, I mean, there's some of the tactics that they use. There are strategic things that come out of that. So just getting conservatives to the streets early in this year, and then also getting them to come together in one place at one time, you know, with one voice in Washington, D.C., right on the front lawn of the Capitol there, that in and of itself was such a boost to morale. It brought this movement around the country together for the first time, and the morale was boosted. All I'm hearing about is, you know, people that had a great time. They met so many people like them. They're more fired up than ever. So that was one thing, was to help bring this movement together, continue the momentum from the Tea Parties, from the August recess, and just sort of send people back home with a mission to go and recruit their friends. So that's one side of it. Obviously, the other side of it is the actual, the point of the protest at the Capitol was to send a message to Congress that people are fed up with big government. They don't want higher taxes. They don't want to spend ourselves into bankruptcy. And this movement, this message was delivered by the people. We almost didn't have to do anything other than create the stage and give the grassroots leaders the opportunity to speak, and they did, and they spoke, and I think it was a huge success in terms of delivering the message, and I do think that we had a big impact on a lot of the moderates and the Blue Dog Democrats in town.
Now, there's been a wide range of estimates about the crowd size that's still being debated today. There's not an official number that we've seen, but there have been estimates from as low as 30,000 to as high as 2 million. What did you figure out? What did FreedomWorks come up with as a number?
Well, we've been thinking, looking at some different analyses and looking at our own photos and anecdotes and things like that, that the number of people who were either at the event or were on the mall trying to get to the event or walking around with a sign was somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 people. The idea that, or the, you know, the fact that we're arguing whether 400,000, whether 500,000, whether 1 million, that's a good thing. That means that clearly it was a big crowd. And so we'll have that debate. We'll show the pictures. We'll continue to show the anecdotes that we have and tell the stories. That's a good thing. Now, I don't know if anyone will ever know, but let's put some perspective on this. The 1963 March on Washington at the Lincoln Memorial, when Martin Luther King gave his famous speech, they had 250,000 or so. And the biggest Vietnam War protest had somewhere around 500 or 600,000. So it's interesting to look at how the left and the media and the academy portray sort of more on the left protest as opposed to how they're going to cover this conservative libertarian protest. Ours will probably never go down in history because the academics on the left control the books that will be written.
So what were some of the highlights of the day for you?
I have to tell you two big things. Number one was being at Freedom Plaza early in the morning. I walked there at 6 a.m. I was staying downtown, and there was no one there. And I walked up and looked at Freedom Plaza, and I said, I can't wait to see how many people are here. And you know, we put the stage together at 6:30 or 7. People were already coming in, and as soon as we got up on stage, got the sound going, watching people streaming in from the metro as groups, the 50 that came from, you know, Shreveport, Louisiana, or the 200 that came from Fort Worth, or, you know, just watching them come in their groups, bring their local tea parties off the buses, from the metros, from cabs, just getting out and filling that area and just overwhelming Freedom Plaza, which supposedly held 5,000 people, and spilling into the streets. And then the atmosphere, the you know, being there, everyone was so positive, so happy. But yet they were, you know, they had that sense of frustration. They came to march. It wasn't just a rally. It wasn't just, you know, your typical thing. These are people, for the most part, that never really protested before or marched before. You know, some had gone to the tea parties, obviously, and done that. But no one had ever done a march of this kind. So the fact that we were able to shut down Pennsylvania, and we packed it all the way from Freedom Plaza down to the Capitol, which is, I think, 1.2 miles, and just sent wave after wave after wave of people, that was just a sight to see. And I loved being a part of that and just having people come up and say, you know, thank you. And I thanked them. I said, you know, all I did was, you know, got the permits and made sure we were good to go there, built the stage. You guys showed up. That's what it's all about.
So who best captured the spirit of the day with their speech? Any one speech that stood out as the one that really captured what was going on there?
I mean, that's a good question. There were a lot of different voices. You know, overall, it was about, you know, big government. It was about the threat to our liberties. I would say Reverend Bryant from Shreveport was my favorite speaker. He got up there, and he's a Southern Baptist preacher, and he gave this fiery speech about noon or so, and the crowd went wild. He basically said our rights come from God, not from man, not from government, and he talked about liberty. He told Americans to stand up, you know, to stand up and take ownership of their government, their communities, and I think that message just resonated. Everyone was fired up. They were, you know, high-fiving each other. They were laughing. They were crying. I mean, it was just an amazing sight. So I think he really kicked off the day and summed it up and said, look, we've got to take this back, and this is what we've got to do. We've got to continue to come together and build on this movement. And he to me, was just the best speaker there.
So put on your media watchdog hat. How well did the media cover this event? And give us some of the highlights and lowlights, and both about just the substance of the event and the attendance figures.
Well, let's start here. I will give kudos to the media for actually writing about the event, for actually covering it. That was probably the best thing I could say, is that the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN and Fox, MSNBC, everyone covered the event. They showed pictures, or they showed footage, or they wrote articles. We did get front page coverage in the Washington Post. A couple of beefs I have with the media. Number one, they barely paid attention to the stage. They barely paid attention to the faces that were there, the voices, what they were saying. Most of the reporting sort of was based on people that came up to D.C. that did have a message of their own, but they basically paid no attention to the people on the stage. Well, that's kind of interesting, because a lot of the coverage later on was this about race. Well, it's interesting, because I think about 25% of our speakers or so were black. But yet, Jimmy Carter and Maxine Waters and all these guys are making the argument that this is a bunch of racists. Well, it clearly the journalist or the congressman didn't watch the C-SPAN coverage of the event. By the way, C-SPAN gave the best coverage. They covered 3 hours of the event. They showed the crowd. They showed the speakers, and they got a sense of the size of the thing. As far as judging the numbers, I thought they did an appalling job. I thought a lot of the numbers were based on, and actually one reporter told me, I just read it from someone else, that there were tens of thousands. That's what I ran with. If they would have waited until 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon to really see the peak of the crowd, they probably could have gotten a better estimate. And also, I felt like NBC at one particular time, they ran, I think it was the nightly news that evening, they found the three most extreme people there, the three people with the goofiest reasons for being there, and they aired those. It was an absolute attempt to marginalize, to discredit, to ignore the message, and it was just ridiculous.
Well, I think that's what they think their job is.
Well, the great thing is that the videos are out there, the videos from C-SPAN, the videos from other reporters who actually did a pretty good job talking to people. Reason TV did a great piece on this. They're out there. People are going to email these around. They're emailing the pictures. The you know, hundreds of thousands that showed up, that's an audience in and of itself, and they're going to go back to their communities and tell their stories and send the pictures around, send the videos around. And it becomes pretty clear that the size and magnitude of this thing caught everyone off guard, and that it's much bigger than the 50 or 60,000 that supposedly were there. That's what the New York Times reported, and I believe some of the other outlets did as well.
Well, that's what's interesting about it, too, is just that I think, as you said,
they were caught off guard by that. I think that was a shocking thing for them as they were walking around covering the event. You know, I did notice in watching media coverage, news footage, that it tended to focus on kind of the fringe elements. You know, they did look for those goofy people, the kind of the way out part, rather than the real hardcore activists, you know, which represented the majority of the people that were in attendance. You know, my other beef there, too, I think, is while you give credit for the New York Times to cover it, it was, if you looked at the paper, the interesting thing was is that they put a picture of the rally below the fold on page one, but the story wasn't until page 33. They did a really good job of burying that thing.
Yeah, if this would have been an anti-war protest under President Bush, if this would have been you know, something under President Reagan or you know, anything like that, they would have ran with this. I mean, these are the people in the media that covered Cindy Sheehan for 30 days in August, who camped out, you know, outside of Bush's ranch in Crawford. And is that a news story? Sure. But it got pretty much wall-to-wall coverage for 30 days. Now, look how they handle one of the largest gatherings in Washington's history for a political protest. They cover it maybe a day or two. And, you know, I still haven't gotten that call from the Sunday talk shows to go on and talk about it. They, you know, Leader Army, the chairman of FreedomWorks, hasn't gotten that call. They put on politicians to talk about the health care debate. Well, why was no one talking about the big rally that occurred? I think David Gregory made a reference to it, and they talked about it a little bit, but they didn't talk to anyone that was there. They didn't talk to any of the organizers, and they really just didn't give it the coverage it deserved. And I actually believe that it's pretty clear that if the media covered this to the extent that we think it deserves, it would have a much bigger impact on the debate, and it ultimately would lead to the defeat of Obamacare.
So as I see it, either we have all this momentum that we've built up from the Tea Parties, outrage at the town halls, now the 9/12 march. So we've got this huge group of body of enthusiasts, you know, enthusiastic support. What do you do now to turn that into some real action, you know, as we go forward? What's next?
Well, that's a question that everyone's asking. And, you know, I'm talking to local organizers. I'm asking them that question. I'm talking to some of our coalition partners, Tea Party Patriots and NTU and other great organizations we've worked with. You know, first of all, I think there are short, midterm, and long-term answers to that question. Number one, short-term, everyone's going to stay active. They're going to go home. They're going to recruit their friends. They're going to get involved. You know, they're going to bring new people into this by telling the story of 9/12 and say, we want you to be a part of this movement. They're going to continue to call, to write, to protest. They're going to continue to do that locally and try to get their congressmen to vote the right way on these health care, cap and trade, and then these other bills. You know, midterm, what you're going to see are probably marches on state capitals at some point. You're going to see massive gatherings in American cities like New York City, Chicago, L.A., Houston to get more media attention. You're going to see thousands of people descend upon those cities. You're going to see also probably letter-writing campaigns. You're going to see all these other basic nuts and bolts. And then next year we're going to talk a little bit more about how this translates into politics and into elections. So I expect there to be, you know, people holding candidates' feet to the fire and saying, you know, if you want to run on sort of the Tea Party ticket, if you want to run on our issues, first you have to convince us that you're worth supporting, and then second we'll look at, you know, going door to door and raising money for you. But I do think eventually any political movement, any social movement, eventually comes down to electoral politics. So that's sort of your mid to long term. And then really long term, what I want to do over the course of the next decade or two or the next 50 years is build a permanent machine of grassroots Americans who care about liberty, who are organized to some degree and can defend liberty for the next 50 to 100 years in this country.
I'm glad you brought up this local issue because it reminded me that I hadn't known about this in advance, but I noticed during the day that there were local events being held in other cities. Do you have a feel for how many of those were held and how many people may have attended those?
Sure. I was talking to Jenny Beth Martin with Tea Party Patriots about this. They actually kind of took the lead on cataloging the events that were happening, and she told me that there were events in 45 different states, and there were a total of, I think, 200 that she knew about. The biggest ones that I heard about were in Fort Worth and Los Angeles. I think Fort Worth, I heard, had anywhere between 10,000 to 20,000 people. And the one in L.A. had around 4,000 or 5,000 people in downtown L.A. So, you know, people basically who couldn't afford to come, or they had appointments, or they, you know, they just couldn't get off work. They were just as fired up as the people that were there. And my friend down in Tallahassee spoke to a crowd of 400 at a tea party there on 9/12, and they were watching the C-SPAN live and giving speeches in between, and it was great. It was just a great day, and I think you're going to see a lot more of this going forward.
Now, kind of moving on to a little bit different thing here, what about the charges that FreedomWorks is a front group working on behalf of big corporate interests to defeat Obama's health care plan?
Well, it's kind of funny because it seems like pharma and the health insurance companies are a little bit busy backing Obamacare with a $150 million campaign. So I don't know that they have much money to give to groups that are opposing Obamacare. It's absolutely ridiculous. And by the way, we've got a budget between $6 and $8 million a year, I believe. And for this event, this particular event, we raised, I don't know the exact figure, but I can tell you we raised at least half to 80%. I'll have to find a more detailed analysis of this, but half to 80%, I would say, from our members, from new people coming in who gave money that never had before, people giving $50, $100 here and there. I think in the course of August, my colleague said that, you know, one of the largest gifts we got was $5,000 from an individual. But you know, look, corporations are—they are not necessarily believers in free market economics. You know, typically what they do is they come to D.C., they get their lobbyists to lobby for subsidies, for competitive advantages, you know, for laws that benefit them at the expense of their competitors. Now, small businesses are the ones that really get hit because my dad's a small business owner. He doesn't really have a lobbyist in town. But as he told me, you know, you're kind of my lobbyist. You're lobbying for a fair playing field because I can't afford to. I can't afford higher taxes. I can't afford mandates on health care. And I don't have lobbyists to go in and get, you know, special favors from government. So I think that's just it's a canard. I think they're pulling out all these, you know, all these charges that are just ridiculous. And the latest one has been the racial charge, which, again, if you watch the coverage on C-SPAN, I think you'll see that our white speakers, our black speakers, our Hispanic speakers, they were all quite well received.
So this charge, again, that Don just brought up, I've seen Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann repeatedly try to put charts up and things to show how this is all, you know, as they call it, astroturfed. And so tell us a little more. I mean, have you seen their coverage of this, and how do you respond to them?
Sure. Well, Rachel Maddow and some of the liberal blogs, they've been getting a lot of things wrong. They think they have it figured out. They really haven't gotten any of the facts straight. They're trying to tie DLA Piper Rudnick, which is a law firm in town, which Leader Army used to work for. They're trying to tie them to FreedomWorks and therefore say that, you know, Piper's clients are really behind the protests. Well, a few things. First of all, Piper Rudnick is a mostly Democrat law firm and lobbying group. Army was only lobbying for certain companies on certain things as part of his work there. His work there was completely unrelated to FreedomWorks, and in fact, any of the companies, the pharmaceutical companies represented by Piper, were none too pleased about Army's activities with FreedomWorks and the organization because it was going directly against what they were lobbying for. I mean, this is one of the largest law firms in the world. It might be in the top five. You know, thousands and thousands of, you know, workers and clients and all these different things. It's like saying that one guy that works at a Walmart and, you know, in Texas is somehow tied to, you know, something going on in D.C. that he has no idea about. So it's just kind of ridiculous, but it was the best that they could do to try to discredit this. But if you look at FreedomWorks' history over the last 25 years or so, you will not find an instance where we've gone against our principles. We've always fought for lower taxes, an end to corporate subsidies, you know, none of these things, you know, fought against healthcare going back to 1993, 1994. So it's not like we've changed our position based on what some corporation does. I mean, if you look at the insurance companies back in 93, 94, they were opposing healthcare reform under Clinton, and now they're like that individual mandate, so they're actually in support of aspects of Obamacare. So the charges are ridiculous. It's the best they can do. You know, really it isn't about FreedomWorks, though, ultimately. All we're doing is facilitating grassroots organizing that's happening around the country, and it's been effective. It's been so effective that now we've obtained a memo from the Democrats saying the unions and Organizing for America need to figure out how to compete with this organization that has 14 staff members and is just too nimble for us to deal with.
You brought up how they are starting to use this charge of racism. Of course, Jimmy Carter this week, and there have been others in the media that have been making this. And they really don't seem to offer any evidence, and I think this is something that could really backfire. I want to get your comments on that, because in essence they're saying anyone who opposes Obama is a racist, and that's a, you know, that's about as rough a charge as you can make on somebody.
Absolutely. Again, it shows that they're desperate. It shows that they don't have any policy arguments, and they're losing. And I think it's going to turn off all the people that were there, all the independents that are watching this who opposed Obamacare. They're saying, wait a minute, I'm not a racist. I'm just a regular guy. I couldn't care less about the color of his skin. I do care about his policies. And by the way, again, you know, I want to reiterate that, you know, Mason Weaver, Deneen Borelli, Nick Lott, Charles Lawler, all these guys, African Americans, on the stage opposing Obamacare on Saturday, getting the loud, you know, the loudest cheers as anyone, somehow they're racist. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's a tactic that the left uses, and I saw this when I was a student at UT. It's a tactic they use to silence their opponents. When I was back at UT, we had a lot of debates about affirmative action, about the Michigan Supreme Court case, and things like that. And we had these debates, these forums. We did some activity on that, and they always use, you know, well, you're just opposed to affirmative action because you're a racist. Well, when we had our black members of YCT and our Hispanic members and those guys running our tables, there wasn't a whole lot that they could say about that, but they still made the charge anyway because that's what they do. It goes back to political correctness, which is a tactic the left uses to silence its critics and opposition. It's something that works a lot of time because people get scared. They don't want to be tarred with this idea that you're a racist or you're a homophobe or you're sexist, and it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Put on your political prognosticator's hat, and we've seen yesterday Max Baucus release this long-awaited compromise plan out of the Senate Finance Committee, and it seems to have been met with universal condemnation, left, right, center. Nobody wants to seem to, you know, take any ownership of that or support for it. I mean, where do you think this whole process is headed?
Well, I haven't had a chance to look at the Baucus thing in detail yet. I've been just busy enough with everything in the aftermath. But I will say that this battle is sort of, I mean, the Democrats have lost control of this thing. The Blue Dogs are sitting on the fence. They're trying to figure it out. I think ultimately many of those guys are going to, they're not going to support a public option. They're not going to support the worst parts of the bill. You have the progressives who are demanding this and that. I think the Democrats are really, they have a civil war over this. But what I'm seeing on the right and what I'm hoping for on the right is that, you know, at least the Republicans will stand firm in opposition to, you know, to Obamacare and to the worst things that are out there. And I think that's going to happen. I think the march had a lot to do with that. I think the August recess had a lot to do with that. And quite frankly, I think it's time for the conservatives to go on offense and offer their solutions again. And we, you know, they've tried to do that. I know John Shadegg and Senator DeMint, some of these guys have been trying to do that. The media won't cover their ideas, but really they should go on offense and get the grassroots support behind some of their ideas, like allowing for more competition, buying, you know, health insurance across state lines, tort reform, tinkering with the system to make it better, allowing more people to get health insurance and making health care better. But I think a government takeover at this point is just, it's got to be a failure at this point.
It strikes me that Obama doesn't care what is in the bill that passes. He just wants to get it passed, because once it passes, then they can call it health care reform and then create all these federal bureaucracies, make new rules, and it almost doesn't matter what's in the bill. And so the question is, can they water it down just the right amount where it doesn't lose a lot of supporters on one side, but yet get something that they can pass? I'm dubious as to whether or not they can do it at all. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right that they're trying to pass something. That's the key, because their lesson is that President Clinton's health care plan failed, which led to the 94 elections and, you know, Republicans, you know, gaining a bunch of seats. And So I think that's their fear. They think they have to pass something and you know, put it on the mantle and claim that it's reform. You know, it's funny to me, this debate that we're having, because who would have ever thought weeks ago or months ago, given the overwhelming majorities the Democrats have, that we would be discussing the possibility of this bill going down? I mean, no one would have ever thought it. And he can't blame Republicans at this point. You know, this is a civil war within the Democrat Party, and I think Obama's going to lose. I think he may get something through, but let's just say as a movement, you know, we don't want to see that happen necessarily, but we're a lot better off if he just gets, you know, something through rather than the overall, you know, plan that he wanted. Now, we're going to have to continue to, and fight just as hard, maybe to come back in a couple years and try to undo the damage, and that's always the most difficult part. But if we can stop him here, or we can at least make it very difficult, cap and trade, we have a good deal, a good chance of stopping, and then the agenda next year before the elections, we have a very good chance of stopping a lot of those bad ideas. It took us a while as a movement to get our feet under us with the bailouts and the stimulus and everything, but I think that we're there now, and I think we are what Peter Ackerman had called a force more powerful.
Don, do you have a final thought or question before you go?
No, I think that's about it for me.
All right. Well, Brennan, let me ask you one more thing. Do you have any political aspirations for yourself?
My political aspiration is simply to continue to organize people, help empower them to be active locally. And again, my long-term goal in all this is to build this machine for years to come, and an institution, not only at FreedomWorks, but all these other organizations, to get them on the same page as a coalition. And the way that, you know, I look back to what happened in the 50s with Bill Buckley and National Review and ISI and all these great organizations that were coming together, there was no conservative movement until really about 1955 or so. And my goal is to extend that, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants and help keep this conservative libertarian movement going forward. And again, just build this machine, this political machine that finally is able to compete and defeat the likes of ACORN, SEIU, the environmentalists. And I believe we can do it. And that's what I'm going to spend, hopefully, a lot more years doing and working towards with all of my friends and colleagues.
Okay, let me, our next guest hasn't called in yet, so if you can stay on for another couple of minutes, I'd like to ask you something else. You mentioned
sure.
ACORN, and this has really been interesting all week. We've been seeing these hidden camera works of a couple people that have gone in and really exposed the underbelly, I guess you'd say, of ACORN. What do you think, and all of a sudden the Senate has voted to cut off funds. What is your perspective on all this that's gone on with ACORN and how the media has covered this?
Well, it's kind of funny because James O'Keefe, who did the videos, is a friend of mine, and he might be the most brilliant guy on our side and the most creative, along with Hannah Giles. I haven't met her, but I'm just as proud of her as I am of James. It's an amazing thing that they've accomplished. Literally, two people with the camera have done more investigative journalism than the entire news networks on this issue. If you do a quick search in the Google News, you can find all sorts of things happening with this ACORN scandal. Governors, attorney generals, state lawmakers, federal lawmakers looking into this, trying to cut off funding, looking at investigations, and it's just amazing to watch, first of all, and I just want to say everyone out there should be thankful to James and Hannah for doing this. You know, as a friend and as someone here in D.C. with FreedomWorks, we're going to be working hard to help support them in their campaign to stop the funding of ACORN. So we're asking everyone to call their congressmen, call their state lawmakers, their governors, their attorney generals, demand an end to the public funding, demand investigations, ask the chairman of ACORN to step down. We need to keep the pressure on. And by the way, speaking of keeping the pressure on, I think that's rule number 8 of Rules for Radicals. And James O'Keefe has brilliantly employed Saul Alinsky's strategies against a radical in ACORN and against President Obama, who has benefited from ACORN. So we're going to continue to provide support for them, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. We have a lot of momentum right now, and we have an opportunity to put to bed this criminal organization that has been you know, giving money to the left and getting kickbacks in the form of taxpayer dollars. So I think we've got to keep the pressure on. Don't let them move. We've got to pick the target, freeze it, polarize it, just like Saul Alinsky taught. I think we on the right now, we're scary. We're better community organizers, and we're employing Rules for Radicals in a way that is more effective than the left is doing right now.
Brendan, this has been great. This is Brendan Steinhauser, the Director of Federal and State Campaigns for FreedomWorks. Where can they find you on the Internet, on the web?
Well, I hope everyone will join us at freedomworks.org, and that's the best point of contact. We also have a Facebook group that you can join, and hopefully you'll stay in touch with us and with me personally. You know, I'm going to continue traveling around the country this fall, doing a lot of meetings and training and just meeting with local activists, trying to give them the tools that they need to be more effective. And let me just tell you, I'm inspired by all these people that I meet. I've met a lot of local organizers in you know, big cities and small towns, and these people never thought they'd be involved in politics, but as of this year, they have, and they have just done an amazing job. So I'm looking forward to working with everyone listening and all those potential community organizers out there.
Thank you so much for being with us. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our next guest, we have actually two people from the Laogai Research Institute. First up, we have Nicole Kempton, who is the director of the Laogai Museum here in Washington, D.C. Why we're covering this story this week, we noticed a story a couple weeks ago that said that on September 20th, there's going to be a celebration of the 60th anniversary of the communist takeover of China. I don't think they put it quite that way, but then as this thing started to become a topic of controversy, the White House said, no, it's not on the South Lawn. It's going to be on the Ellipse at the White House. And so we wanted to talk to some people who have a lot of experience with the Chinese government and have been making this their issue for years. So we're going to, in a bit, talk to Harry Wu. But first up, we have Nicole Kempton, the director of the Laogai Museum in Washington. Are you there, Nicole?
I am, yes. Hi.
Great. Thank you for being with us. First, tell us a little bit about the museum and how you became involved with it.
Well, the museum opened in November of last year, and it's sort of the realization of a dream that Harry Wu, who you'll be talking to in a moment, has had for many years. It's a museum that looks into the Laogai system, which Laogai in Chinese is a word for gulag, and it means reform through labor, and it's the largest and most repressive prison camp system in the world, still ongoing. It was established under Mao Zedong with Soviet help in the early 50s, and it continues to be the primary enforcement mechanism for the Chinese Communist Party even today. And so Mr. Wu wanted to memorialize the victims of the Laogai and also educate the public about the ongoing atrocities associated with the system. And so that's kind of what the museum is about. And we're a very small outfit, and obviously, ideally, we would love to open a museum like this in Beijing or Shanghai, but that's just not possible with the current Chinese regime the way it is.
So if people are coming to Washington or they're here now and they want to go visit the museum, how do they find it, and what might they expect to see there?
Well, we're located at 1109 M Street, so we're right downtown in D.C., and we're located in a historic row house, and visitors can see testimony from Laogai survivors. They can also have a look at what these camps typically look like, and they can sort of follow developments in the Laogai throughout history. We also have a section of the museum dedicated to current international trade issues. There's a lot of products being manufactured in the Laogai using forced labor that are making their way into the U.S. And that's an issue that every American can do something about.
Now, are you aware of this event on September 20th?
Yes, we are. We've heard rumors about it for a number of months now, and it seems that there's a group that's been applying for years to raise the Chinese flag to celebrate the October 1st anniversary of the CCP, and it looks like it's going to happen this year, unfortunately.
Is that with the White House cooperation or not?
No, it's not. These people are not affiliated with the U.S. government in any way. It's a separate group that has been applying for a permit, and apparently they've been denied for a number of years, and this year was the first year that they were able to get permission. And I don't know the details of the case. I don't know why they were able to get permission, but certainly it's unfortunate.
And I understand now there's a Hong Kong exhibit at the museum. What is that about?
Yes, well, we've actually just, in cooperation with Umbridge Editions, which is a socially conscious publishing house located in New York, we are publishing a new book on the Laogai, which is a really extensive photojournalistic view of the system, and it's aimed at a general readership and really examines the Laogai as the kind of primary enforcement mechanism of the Chinese Communist Party. So we're going to Hong Kong next week to launch the book in Asia and also to do a traveling exhibition in Hong Kong right under the nose of the Chinese government to say, this system still exists and to look at certain cases within the system.
And how can people get that book? Can they find it online?
They can order it on Amazon. It's available. It's available for ordering now, and soon they'll also be able to find it on our website, which is www.laogai.org.
And the book is called Laogai: The Machinery of Repression in China.
That's right.
Is that correct? Okay. All right, Nicole, it's been very helpful. And let's see, is Harry there with you, or are we going to be
getting
a separate call from him? Okay.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Well,
hold on just one moment.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hi, Mr.
Wu.
Harry Wu. Well,
yeah.
Thank you for being with us. Harry is the executive director of the Laogai Research Institute and the author of a book called Bitter Winds about his 19 years in the Chinese gulag. So he has the firsthand experience to know well about this. So Harry, tell us, why did you actually go to prison and spend 19 years there?
Yeah, that was in 1957, the Chinese Communist and Mao Zedong have a plan to according to communism revolution idea, want to abolish two classes, landlord class and bourgeois class. So I didn't know that. I just feel that it's okay. But my father was a banker, so is a bourgeois members. So my father and me both was labeled as a counter-revolutionary capitalist bourgeois and the rightist. And there's no court, no any sentence, no lawyer, whatever, just sent to the labor camp. And in the first night, the Chinese warden told me that I was sentenced to life. And it is true. We stand over there, and later that 1976, Mao Zedong was dying. And we just know that either we will be executed or we will released. So after a couple of years, we got a release. But
now,
many people have passed away.
Now, had you done anything in defiance of the government, or was it just the fact that, as you say, your father was a banker and you were considered?
I actually did not do anything because I didn't join any party or want to make a poster on the wall, whatever. I didn't. But in some so-called study class, I I say that in 1956, October, Soviet Red Army suppressed the Hungarian people, and I feel that is a kind of violation of international law. And then they say, well, this is a counter-revolutionary announcement that they charge me. That's it.
And what was life like in the Laogai prison?
Well, that's quite simple. Two major of the Laogai. Lao, that means labor. Gai, it means reform. It means brainwashing. So everybody in the labor camp was forced to labor. Whatever you labor in a farm, or labor in a coal mine, or steel factory, or chemical factory, that's, yeah, this is labor. I work in the coal mine, two shifts a day, 12 to 12. Well, that's, and in the farm, we, when the sun setting up, we move out, and then when the sun setting down, we come back to the barracks, and every night have a 2-hour political study. It means you have to betray yourself, betray other people. That's simple.
Did they torture you when you were there? Physically?
Yeah, I was tortured very frequently. They broke my arm because I reject the requirement that the government asked everybody have to burn their books, and I tried to hide the books, include Shakespeare, include Mark Twain's selection, include the dictionary, everything, and then they find out, and then handle me to a thousands audience and broke up my arm.
And how did you eventually get out of prison and then eventually after that out of China?
Well, I got a kind of rehabilitation, and, you know, I was forced to commit suicide twice in the camp. But 1979, they released all of the survival, and I was in China in the Geotechnical University. And then 5 years later, 1985, I got an invitation from UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And I come here as a visiting scholar. It's a very difficult situation because I don't have any money, I don't have any friends, I cannot speak very good English. But anyway, I know that finally I leave the small cage to a big cage, and finally I leave the cage, I become a free man. Okay. So when I came to the United States, I told myself I'm a free man. I was 50 years old, and say, why just forget about the past? Okay, forget about a nightmare and let him go. And I want to earn money. I want to set up a family and have a peace life. That's my, you know, my request. But unfortunately, in 1990, American Senate, particularly the Senator Jesse Helms, have a hearing. I told him that I was in the prison camp 19 years, and I've been 12 labor camps. Everybody very shocked. And finally, the Senate say, well, can you tell us how many camps in there and how many people there? And I said, sorry, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Even today, the Americans didn't know how many labor camps there, how many people was there. And then the Senate very kind say, can you, you know, find it for us? So I back to China a couple of times.
Could you speak up just a little bit, please?
Yeah. And I back to China to find out that sometimes posing a businessman walking the camp talking about buy the products, sometimes pose like a policeman, just want to get in to take a photo, and sometimes pose a police family, a prisoner family, and talk to the prisoners. Yeah. But finally, in 1995, Chinese rearrest me, and they charged me stealing state secrets. So I was put in the jail again. It's a sentence of 15 years until next year, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the American is very helpful. So they put a high pressure, and U.S. Congress put a high pressure. Anyway, they have to release me. I will spend about 2 months in the jail, but the sentence will until next year.
So China is now generally referred to as this country that has become a great capitalist power, though it still has a communist, the Communist Party in charge. But how does that work out? I mean, I know they still have the big pictures of Mao Zedong, and even though it has been widely recognized that he was responsible for the murder of 60 to 80 million people, maybe more. So what do you think of this sort of dual system there, that they have a supposedly capitalist system and a communist government?
Well, this is a kind of a big problem, okay? First of all, China in political system majorly have not changed. It's one party ruling. No election, no democracy, and they have military power and police power, control everyone, and the Lao Gai camp still there, and no religious freedom, Roma Catholics illegal inside China, and they have a very cruel policy, so-called one-child policy, and if you have more than one kid, that's illegal, that's forced you to sterilize, they forced to disabortion. Okay, and China executed more than thousands of people, we don't know how many, and they're using the death row prisoners' organ for organ transplant. Whatever, this is a kind of violation in political situation. In the economy situation, there's something changed, but the economy is still controlled by the government, controlled the Communist Party. But they allow the people become a capitalist, and you can work in that, have a small restaurant, have a company, we have whatever, you can have your business. But major company, and particularly they came to New York stock market, is owned by the government. So we don't know what is the near future happen. Okay.
Don't know what?
We don't know the near future.
Okay.
But
So China holds more than $700 billion in bonds.
That is a big problem, $700 billion. But I just suggest that China has so many poor people, their children cannot go to school, the children cannot have insurance. Why you take 10% to share with the people? But it's not going to
so
handle to the American. That's why the American, you know, very care about the Chinese holding their bond. Okay.
Yes, so you think this is a big cause for concern, that China has so much of our bonds, and that, you know, that we rely on them so heavily to keep getting dollars to keep running our government, huh?
Well, yes, the Obamas very clearly say, well, this is American bond. American prosperity is a part of it, relate to Chinese government. And this is a communist regime. There's no freedom, no democracy there. It's a very critical situation. Okay.
So what do you see as the media's role in this country? How much does the media tend to downplay the human rights issues and the prison issues and the lack of freedom and religious freedom to gain the favor and such of China. How do you view the media in that regard?
Well, I like to say some words about American media. Okay, I was interviewed by American TV station and American newspaper frequently, but recently I probably only get a BBC and French, German, and Italian, very few American newspaper, American TV going to interview me, because in their paper, suppose nobody talking about religious freedom, nobody talking about the forced abortion, nobody talking about the Lao guy. You have to know Soviet have the Gulag, China have the Lao guy. And the victim of the Lao guy is much more than the Gulag. But unfortunately, the people never hear about it. They don't want to talk about it. Okay? So whatever, if American people hear about it and know about it, there's a huge Lao guy camp in China. They will say, what should we do? We cannot do our business with them. We cannot use the forced labor, cheap labor force over there. We have to get the people free first. Unfortunately, they don't. From the President Clinton to President Bush and until today. For example, last July, I met President Bush in White House, and President Bush shake my hand and say, what is the problem in China? And she right away say, hey, human rights. I say, yeah, that's human rights. I right away give President Bush a paper. It means December 2005, the Congress passed a resolution condemned the Chinese Lao Gai systems. And I said, would you, as a president of the United States, condemn the Chinese Lao Gai systems? And she said, well, I will. But it never happened. This is kind of, human rights issues such seriously today in China. But we only handle with Chinese about the business, about the contract, okay, from Google, from Yahoo, from Cisco, okay, from General Motors, just care about their investment, just care about their profit. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because China have a huge cheap labor force, okay, and all the labor force and all the land is owned by the government. Okay, that's why the communist leader become the honor guest in the White House, but not all the communist guests. Fidel Castro never got the invitation. Okay, Jin Zhengru never got the invitation. Only Chinese communist leader. Okay.
Well, we're just about out of time, Harry. A couple more things, real quickly though. Should America view China as a military threat to our national security at this point?
In this moment, not yet. Chinese just on the way to rebuild their military forces. They are building their missiles, nuclear weapon system, air carrier. I don't know. In the near future, could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, one more time, tell people how they can find your museum on the website.
Our museum was on 1109. M Street, Northwest, between 11 and 12 in Washington, D.C. I hope everybody can just take a look. You know, it's not only seeing the Gulag and Holocaust, but also Chinese Lao Gai. Even today, China has become a free country, as a democratic country. We still have to remember China have a Lao Gai existence.
Okay, and what is your website? And we're going to have to leave it there.
The Lao Gai is Lao Gai, L-A-O-G-A-I, at laogai.org.
That's L-A-O-G-A-I.
G-A-I.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. At laogai.org.
Okay. All right, Harry, thank you, and thanks for your great efforts to bring this to everyone's attention, and it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week's episode of Take Aim, and we will be back next week, same time, same station, with two new great guests, and thank you for tuning in. Till then,